We good now?
Yes, we're good now. Good morning, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Welcome to the last major event for Seize the Day, the 2018 Apollo Bay Seafood Festival. This event's called Conversations on the Edge, and we have got a cracker lineup of speakers for you today. So I hope you really enjoy it. Before I introduce all of the wonderful farmers, fishers and scientists we've got lined up, I've got a couple of housekeeping things to point out. So toilets are directly behind you. We only have one of each in the surf club. There are public toilets down on the foreshore in that direction and in that direction if things get a little oversubscribed in the toilet area. The other thing I really do need to point out is that today is an active patrol day for the local Surf Life Saving Club. So we must allow access to the radio room and to the storage areas around the back. If there is an emergency, we may have to shift a little sideways to allow our patrol people in and out if they need to get in and out quickly. Let's hope that doesn't happen today. So, but just so that you're aware, we need to have full access through there. Tea and coffee provided by our local roasters, Hello Coffee, downstairs. I'm hoping you've all had coffee. There will be morning tea served in the bar area when we break after the first session. And the other thing I need to do today is to introduce you to Richard Cornish and Hilary McNevin. Those of you who have been to some of the other festival events will already have seen these two fabulous people in action. They've been emceeing for us all weekend, and we are just so delighted to have their abundant talents. Thank you both so much. Their palpable passions for all things food and food-related, and that has really come out over the course of the weekend, and I'm sure you'll feel that again today. And just my last little bit, please, a quote from Charles Massey's book, The Call of the Reed Warbler, and I think it speaks to why we're here today, why we have brought together the group of speakers that we've brought together for you, and I'm hoping some of the things that you will take away at the end of the day. And a quote. Thank you, Charles. Yeomans, who Charles will possibly talk about later, and who is a great Australian farmer and researcher, concluded that it is only regenerative farming that could turn things around. The important people, he said, are the rebel farmers who have not been bastardised and who have stuck to the healthy and meaningful way of working with their soil and farming with nature. And I think that applies for our fishers as well. So welcome. Thank you for coming today. Richard.
Thanks, Liz. Thank you. Thank you. This has been one of the best festivals that Hilary and I have ever been to. The amount of energy has been palpable, hasn't it?
Yes, yeah, completely overwhelming and beautiful and warming and welcoming.
There's something about Apollo Bay. Who's local here? You guys have got a certain energy about you. You guys don't like to be told what to do, but you sure like having a good time and you know how to think as well.
Yes.
And it's a pleasure to be here. All right. We've got a lot to get through today. We're going to stick to time.
Yes.
So today is Conversations on the Edge. Hilary, when we're talking about this, what did you feel about the topic?
Well, I actually went to edge as in getting a bit edgy in the conversation, pushing boundaries, pushing envelopes, and I'm actually excited today because the people we are talking to do that on a daily basis. They ask the hard questions and seek the answers. So that's what I'm thinking. What did you take from the name Conversations on the Edge?
I thought the Conversations on the Edge were talking to farmers and to fishers.
Yes.
And basically is that border between the two is the edge. But perhaps today we'd like to break that border and look at as the whole land and sea as being as one and one community.
That's perfect too. Okay. I think we're going to push boundaries and and also look at things wholeheartedly.
Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah. So that's the way we'd like to set up today. We're running to a fair bit of serious time today. There's three sessions today. From now until 11:15 is Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food. We break for morning tea. And then at 11:40, we're straight back in the room until 12:30 with Local Catch, talking to local fishers. And it's lunch for 58.53 minutes. And you come in late, right. You're going to be in so much trouble. You'll be dead to me. All right. 1:30 to 2:30.
He means it.
We've got sustainable futures. Some really impressive speakers today. And then at 2:35, the bar opens till 3:30. All right. Please turn your phones off now. Take that time. We don't want that today to be interrupted by phones. Hillary, you've got some very important business.
Yes, phones off, please. And something that means an awful lot to all of the community here and beyond is the acknowledgement of country. And we would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, the Gunnabanaad and Gullajun communities. And we would also like to pay respects to elders past and present. Richard.
Thanks, Hillary. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let's get into it. Land. We're talking about land today. And to continue that idea of land, it's about the land and the present custodians of that land, the farmers of Australia. Our soils are ancient, and of not having that ground down glacial soils of Europe where many of our first farmers came from. When they first came here, they made some terrible mistakes. Clear felled trees leading to gully erosion, introduced rabbits and a host of other feral pests, brought in hard-hoofed animals, and since the mid-20th century wars, we've begun a chemical regime that severely affected the unseen microbiological army of bugs, fungi, nematodes and insects that exist under the soil. Today, this is the framework we're working in. We discover how farmers from the Otways and beyond are innovating and finding new ways to regenerate the land and how that affects the quality and flavour of food. That's our framework today. And we have, speaking today, we have Ros Denny from St Eyre Farm. We have Jodie Lawson from the Green Acre, and we have Paul and Wendy Troughton from Forest Foods. First up, though, a sheep farmer from the Monaro Plains. He had a bit of a road to Damascus conversion one day, and he realised that the way his family were farming on that great piece of land up north of Dalgety and between Dalgety and Canberra, how people hadn't been farming the correct way. He underwent that transformation and informed everything he did from then, and from that experience he wrote this seminal piece of literature. If you haven't read it, please do so. If you're into regenerative farming, this will give you a whole new way of thinking about it. It'll also give you a whole new way of thinking about the land on which we live. Will you please welcome Dr. Charles Massey, OAM. Charles.
Thanks very much, Richard, and welcome everyone to coming. I'd just say it wasn't so much a road to Damascus experience for me. I was a slow learner after lots of mistakes, which I'll touch on. But my focus today is to set up, to bookend the day and set up the context for the three wonderful farmers, Ros, Paul and Jodie beside me and their families. Because, as Richard alluded to, this new movement of regenerative farming, if you like, I call it an underground insurgency playing on the soil, and it is a change agent issue and hugely important for societal health, human health and landscape health. And it translates right through to society and our planet, which I'll touch on. So I'll just quickly give you an overview of the current situation. The average age of farmers in Australia is 60 and growing. I'm a good example. In male farmers in Australia, there's double the rate of suicide of urban males, same cohorts. And we're losing about 46 farmers a week. So there's a system that's broken somewhere. We've moved away from the way we co-evolved in our landscapes and to work. And there's huge issues to do with human health. The entire industrial agricultural system is driven by some of the world's biggest multinationals. Your chemical, your pharmaceutical countries, your big food processors, your traders, and your retailers, who are very keen on driving prices down for farmers. The net result of what they do to food is basically strip nutrients out of it. And I'm talking about the worst examples of industrial farming. So to get to a retail shelf in Australia, a lot of white foods, etc., there's not many nutrients in it compared to coming off a healthy soil. And that's underpinned by this absolutely suicidal philosophy that it's driven by the big end of town, which is economic rationalism and greed. And the more greed and economic rationalism, the more destruction there is of Earth systems, which has now pushed us into this new epoch called the Anthropocene. So the human health issue is nutrients dropping now in a lot of our retail food. And there's a lot of research now around to show it's plummeted in a lot of the food off the worst of industrial landscapes and that food processing system. One I just want to put on your radar, which people aren't aware because there's a lot of emerging research now, is that to enable a lot of industrial broadacre food production, we use what's called Roundup or glyphosate. The evidence that's now emerging is that it is in all our food, coming through the soil. It's even in baby's milk. And it's having a huge impact on our gut microbiome, our microflora, which is the first and major defence system for our entire immune system. And the Monsantos of this world are fighting tooth and nail to stop it, but the court cases are now mounting in the evidence, and I would say it's going to be as big, if not bigger, than tobacco, so keep that on your radar. And I won't get into the bigger picture, which is what I was mentioning about we've moved into the Anthropocene. This is where I am still attached today, and you, a lot of the leading climate and other scientists are involved in this field. And to me, it's incontrovertible that we've now moved into an unstable and unsafe phase of our pristine planet, this extraordinary blue-green planet where life itself created conditions for life. It was bacteria that first put oxygen up. And it's not just climate in this Anthropocene issue. There's seven other interrelated Earth systems like water, biodiversity, land use, nitrogen, phosphorus, interconnection. The mounting evidence is that the worst of industrial ag is destabilising seven out of those eight systems, the eighth being ozone that we don't impact. The good news from that is that a regenerative agriculture can address that. We know regenerative ag can put a lot of carbon back into the soil, long-lasting carbon, in a major drawdown effect. So that's really a brief sketch of the context, and the good news is what farmers like these on my left are doing. So what I'm saying is the system is pretty much broken now. We can't keep going. We need a new story. And I think the new story is the interconnection between urban and regenerative farmers and the urban food farmers and the whole thing, because it's a win-win on many respects. And what this story does is links healthy landscapes to healthy people and healthy societies, and then regenerates the planet. And the key to this, as I try to explain as the core of my book, is gaining ecological literacy, the ability to read a landscape. And I can tell you I couldn't. So my journey, I had to take over the farm at the age of 22. My father had a heart attack. I'd grown up on a farm, but I knew bugger all about managing it. So I asked the best people around, and I was indoctrinated into best practice. And I made horrible mistakes. I set stock and overgrazed my country. I ploughed sandy paddocks that were washed away, etc. I used chemicals. So I was a slow learner, and I started to encounter through an innovative merino stud we had regenerative farmers. And so I started to adopt the practices, and I ended up going back to university in my late 50s and doing a PhD, looking at what was going on and why these guys had flipped. And out of that I realised that from my own journey that I'd look at a landscape and I couldn't read whether it was functioning healthily. And as Richard alluded to, we function totally different in Australia to where agriculture is evolved in the European agriculture in those humid, rich soils. And so I've simplified the story down to five basic landscape functions. Obviously the solar that drives it with sugars from plants, healthy soils, healthy water cycle, biodiversity. And the big one I've put into other models is what one farmer said, this: one square foot of real estate, what goes on between our ears, our worldview on which way we go and how we're indoctrinated. And a key, I can just give you an example of one cycle, the soil mineral cycles, relates to the people on my left. If you go putting a lot of industrial fertiliser and chemicals on, you kill off the huge microbiology under the soil, which in a healthy soil can be 10 times more under the soil than operating above the soil. And one of the key players in that, there's hundreds of billions of bacteria involved, but is our fungus. And we've got truffle groves here on the left. But I'm talking about the root fungus on plants, what's called microalgal fungi. And in a healthy soil, they have a partnership with the plants. So the plants give them root sugars, and their bargain is to go out and hunt the nutrients. And in a cubic metre of soil, healthy soil, they will have up to 42 kilometres of these microtubes getting those nutrients. You go spraying and fertilising, you shut that down, and you end up, the plants are dependent, they're like drug addicts on getting the nutrient, very few nutrients we put in fertilisers. So that's just one example of getting your functions right. So I guess the big story I'm talking about is recreating through regenerative ag and this food connection, this whole new view of society and health. And it hinges on healthy food coming off our regenerative landscapes. And about 2,500 years ago, a guy called Hippocrates, he's the guy that gave the medical profession their ethical standards. And he said, "Let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food." And a corollary to that is there's a wonderful landscape historian in America called Donald Worcester. And he laid down three principles of good farming. It should make people healthier, first. Second, it should promote a just society. And third, it should preserve the earth and its network of life. And I would add to that, not this static view of preservation or sustainability, which I don't like that term. We need something more open-ended, which is regenerative. And so, in conclusion, what I'm saying is the thinking that's got us into the mess isn't going to get us out of it. We need a new story and a new approach. It's an old story too, but it's providing different solutions. And these farmers on my left are doing this, and so I highly commend them to you, and it'll be interesting to see what they've got to say. Thank you.
Thanks, Charles. Thank you. We'll have lots of questions rising up through the afternoon. If you're one of the shy people who don't like asking questions, Hilary McNevin is there, and if just whisper in her ear, she will ask the question on your behalf. We'd like to have everyone have a voice. Charles, before we move on, while the spotlight's still on you, what I'd like to just ask you, that's the framework you're talking about, but can you just elucidate some of the stories about your own personal experience on your farm about some of the mistakes you've made and how you learn from them?
Well, the classic was gung-ho young farmer, go up and plough a paddock. I was right into growing monoculture pastures, which is not all negative. You need your legumes from Lucerne and stuff. And I just didn't think. We'd sit in under an ancient half-billion-year-old metamorphic hill, so leach soils. It was a bit sandy. I said, we won't get a storm, I'll plough them up. And as I drove off, I thought that, and 2 days later, we had a storm that gutted that paddock and took me half a day to shovel the soil off the floodgate and the fences. And the other thing was, which most of us have done, we leave our sheep or cattle in paddocks, what's called set stocking. They're not rotated. And what they do, and that's what happened to, I relate in the book, just out here in the Western Districts, it took one farmer coming over from Tassie, one of the first, Van Diemen's Land then, one of the first settlers. It took him only 15 years of set stocking to destroy this extraordinary co-evolved landscape with big soakages and chain of ponds, creeks. Only 15 years, those stock, by being left there, they eat out the most nutritious perennial deep-rooted grasses. And within 15 years, it was gullies, salt, trees were falling in. And I set stock without even knowing what I was doing because I was illiterate, landscape illiterate. I could not read how it was functioning, that landscape and those cycles.
You talk about reading the landscape. You weren't the, your family weren't the first people to live on your property. There are people using your land long before you were there. You've got some stories about the people there before you?
Well, in particular, I've become very good friends with an Indigenous elder from the Ngarrigo people. And so they were the ones that were there the longest. And I run an annual burning day with him now, Cool Patch Burning, because we know...
Just explain a little bit about burning. You're not in a firebug, are you? No.
Only in a controlled fashion in the order.
Tell me, I'm rather interested. Tell me about controlled burning.
I was fire captain for about 3-4 years and we had a firebug and that wasn't much fun. We had 60 fires we had to fight, so different sort of firebugging. We know Australian, about 60-70% of Australia's vegetation, one way or another, is adapted to fire and smoke for its germination of seed, propagules and stuff. So we are a fiery continent. And over 2,000 generations, and I noticed Bruce Pascoe up the back here can talk to this better than me, but the Indigenous people have evolved extraordinary skill in burning at the right time for all sorts of reasons. Bill Gammage explained that in The Greatest Estate on Earth, some of that. But from my observation of working with this guy, Rod Mason, they understand the late afternoon switch of moisture going back into the soil and all that sort of stuff. And if you burn at the right time, you don't only reduce dangerous fuel load, but you're encouraging germination of species in a nourishing environment and fixing up all sorts of things, putting right charcoal into the soil, etc. So, and following an untold story in our district of massacres and all sorts of stuff, the early shepherds that came in did set stock. And I'd say it was very similar to Western Victoria. Our landscape crashed very quickly.
Tell me about your landscape. You talked about soils and rocks being 500 million years old. Mm. Can you just give us a visual description of the Monaro, because it is unique?
Sure. I should point out that two-thirds of our continent goes up to about 3.5 billion years old. That's why we have these leached soils. And when the agricultural practices came from Europe, they were assuming rich, nutrient-rich soil, nutrient-dense soils, etc. So the Monaro is a combination of those old soils and then granitic, big granite extrusion soils. So, and also basalt, which is naturally treeless. And the other, our granite soils, grassy woodland, which has all been overcleared, which we're now getting back to about 25% of the farm back into functional vegetation for biodiversity and all that. And then those rough hills below which I ploughed. So it's a beautiful rolling landscape, a bit like what I've seen in Patagonia and Tibetan Plateau. It's gorgeous temperate grasslands, and which we're trying to regenerate, getting our native grasses back.
And you talk about the most important bit of real estate being the one cubic foot, and on top of our shoulders. Can you just talk, just before we move on, just about the importance of the creative human element in regenerative farming?
It's a really good question. I think it's to do with the heart. Once we connect with a living landscape and see it not as an industrial substrate to extract something from it, but this living, evolving, functioning landscape, and we start identifying with the creatures on it, and its previous history, which we can learn from with our Indigenous people. That's the creative element, because it shifts your mind totally to a nurturing, creative, and the possibility of regeneration rather than extraction and continual decline. Yeah.
You talked about the head, we talked about the heart. In Spain, they talk about la cabeza, la corazón y las cojones. It takes guts to be a farmer who stands out and breaks the trend, doesn't it?
As you're alluding to, you need big balls, yes. it does, it's lonely. And I've talked to one of the farmers, Paula, I think, I forget who it was now, but previously, but the really good change agency organisations in Australia, and it's across the spectrum, regenerative ag, it's from biological farming to, you know, holistic grazing. The really good change agencies, and Otway Agroforestry is a great example, not far away, they have mentoring systems so that in that lonely process you've got support and encouragement. But it can be lonely, because you're taking on a worldview that's opposite.
Yeah. And that's why those human relations extending out, and like the fungus underground, you guys, the regenerative farmers, somehow find each other. You guys are always reaching out to each other and finding each other no matter where you are, aren't you?
That's true. It's a great network out there. It's growing. And the other big difference, I think, is the excitement involved in getting into something that's regenerative. It's onward open and it's creative, as you said.
Charles, we'll have, the next thing next to you is Ros Denny. She's at Sinair Farm, which is just how far away are we?
25 minutes.
25 minutes that way, mm-hmm. on the air.
Yeah, on the limestone hills between the Eyre Valley Wildlife Reserve and Bass Strait.
Okay. Yeah. Now tell me, we might have to speak up a bit because someone's got some sort of piece of machinery downstairs, so we might raise our voices a little bit. Tell me, what's your story? When did you arrive at your property?
So we've been there for 6 years and running our farm and livestock for 5 years. Yep. But it's actually, I've got a little bit of an advantage because it's a tract of land that's been in my family since 1909. So, that's always good to know. And pre-1850 it was actually renowned as a big, diverse grassland that was a hunting ground for the Gadabinut. So it was never really like much of the Otways like cleared for tree felling, and then it was always open grassland with a few she oaks. Yeah, so we returned, five years ago.
What was it like when you returned to the land? What would it look like? Was it in good nick? Was it in good condition?
Oh, it was a mess actually, because it had been neglected through various family reasons, and we took on 120 acres to begin with, and we purchased 30 adjoining acres, and we came down for the summer and thought we were, we just were pulling out wire, and, there was a stock agent that just had cattle going everywhere, selectively grazing, and there was one operable trough. But
when you say selectively grazing, that just means the fences are buggered, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, they overgraze in certain spots. It's like what Charles is talking about when there's select grazing, they will overgraze and, so what's under the ground is actually, if the pasture is really short, it's not going to support anything underground at all, and that's just as what is underground is what we are eating. That's how simple it is.
And the soils in your place are a bit different because you're not on the volcanic soil or the heavy country, are you? You're on sort of calciferous sand dunes there, which are really delicate.
Yes. So delicate management.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was your response? What was your response to this situation? You've got a farm that's degraded, the fences are in a bad condition, and you're looking around the country, you're looking... What did you do? What was your reaction to that farm?
So, starting right at the beginning is an expensive place to start. But organisations and educating yourself and knowing that you're in this really unique position between, the Eyre Valley and Bass Strait, and you can see the condition of the livestock. And so we developed this whole farm plan with, organisations like Landcare and strategic, shelter and, establishing all of those things. And
when you say shelter, what does shelter mean?
Shelter belts, for cattle and, treeing up so that you can stop all those winds that come off, Bass Strait for livestock, but also for, all the biodiversity and the incredible bird life that's around. So I started looking at it as a whole thing that...
So, and because you've got these particular soils and because of the mm-hmm. particular nutrient level, you chose a breed that's not normally raised in Victoria.
Yeah, it's not normally. So we looked at different types of cattle, knowing that we wanted to do a paddock to plate beef enterprise, and we looked into... we arrived at a breed that we crossbreed with Angus, and they're a French breed, Bazardet, that are known for their feed efficiency. And so because we have a lot of native pasture, and to me, like, that is really valuable, and that's something that you know, by dividing up the paddocks and resting paddocks and using the livestock and allowing things to, you know, regenerate. It's, you know, it's sort of developing those grasslands and, you know, the beef, the cattle actually perform, yeah, well on those grasslands. So that's, yeah.
Ross, tell me about what's the temperament of the Basildon like? Like, you know, like early, like some types of Angus, you get strains of Angus that just see a fence and want to run through it. You know, they get other ones that are more placid.
Okay. Well, I just think that perhaps the farmer isn't doing the right thing if he's got livestock that are going to do that.
Okay.
So, you know, when you start from scratch, like we did, it's a whole farm system. It's stockyards and, you know, so we got down and designed yards for, you know, that I could handle on my own, and I often handle bulls on my own as well. And, you know, even designing, you know, a system where, you know, we did research into Temple Grandin, who's an autistic lady in America, who basically got down with the animals and you know, worked out their, you know, what stressed them and what did, and all our stockyards are curved and, yeah, you know, so it's all about, you know, the actual health and happiness of the animals that you produce in a paddock-to-plate enterprise. You know, what ends up on the plate, that all shows.
You talk about health and happiness.
Mm.
What's it like being a farmer looking at a contented herd with their heads down or even laying down and chewing their cud? What's it feel like?
Oh, it's quite beautiful. Yeah.
Do you think there's something innate about the people who choose to farm or are farming chosen for them, that when they look at animals, there's a certain contentedness they get and they actually have an empathy for the animals? I'm just speaking from my own experience coming from a dairy farm. When you see an animal head down, grazing happily, it's like, okay, my job's done, I'm happy now. But when you see an animal in distress or, you know, not looking well, you feel real something for that animal?
Oh, well, yeah, I'm fortunate I haven't had animals in that, you know, in that state. Well, actually, you know, when you, you're carving down and,
yep,
you know, if you have to help, it's, yeah, I feel enormously connected and, you know, I'm their lifeline and yeah, so I get pretty stressed at those times.
It's
something you have to take on board that, and, you know, that I'm around some pretty traditional farming families and I was told very early on that where you get live ones, you get dead ones.
Yeah, you want
and so you have to realise sometimes that you can't be a magician and that you can only provide, you know, the best care that you can.
As you're saying those words, Ros, Paul Troughton from Forest Verge is nodding his head. You couldn't see him nodding his head vigorously. Paul, you've got a dairy farm up in the hills. Can you tell us where you are and what you do and what's your story?
Wendy and I bought our farm about 11 years ago, coming from New Zealand, and had quite an extensive family history of dairy farming there, going right back to Ireland. So, and I think that innate nature of looking at contented cows comes into the picture there. But anyway, so we bought our farm and bought it because we really loved the area, close to Wendy's parents, so that gave us a good connection back with family. Wendy'd been with me in New Zealand for 13 years, she milking over there for my parents. So her turn to come home and get stuck into it here.
So how do we pronounce the name? Is it Durangameat?
Durangameat.
Durangameat, sorry. And so you for a while there, you were supplying the big boys with commodity milk. What happened there?
Yeah, that's a sore point. It's in my notes here. It's probably about the toughest time in my farming career, just getting paid not enough for our milk. So you just feel like you're going backwards. It's no fun farming and that, like that. And you talked about suicides and things. That's when all those dark thoughts start sort of creeping into the daily picture. It makes it pretty hard going.
You've had those feelings?
Occasionally you just go, oh, what are we doing this for? You know,
yeah.
Really hurts. You just
But you decided to take so the money's bleeding. You've got having to bring feed into the farm. You made a big decision, didn't you? You decided to do something different. You decided to do something incredibly creative.
It's probably evolved rather than a snap decision. With the regenerative nature of our farming, we've been composting for a long time, large-scale on-farm composting. That's been a big part of it. But we were pushing our stocking rate, trying to think we were back in New Zealand maybe, and cow to the acre is sort of the standard there. So we...
So you say one cow to one acre.
Yeah, okay. and that's old terminology, but it's an easy one to get your head around. So we pulled back our stocking rate from, with our total acres, from about 400 to around about 320 now. So that's significantly reduced our reliance on brought-in feed, was the number one factor there. Probably a little bit better cow health, and probably staff and personal health's a bit better too, just less stress in the system.
All right, so what change allowed you to make that destocking?
Well, really just doing the figures in a bad year when you were having to still buy feed in, particularly grain. And we just said, well, this isn't sustainable. Talking about sustainable farming, that wasn't sustainable. It was a business decision, first of all. In a good year, that's, you can probably make money by high input feeding. You can. But we soon realised that we are part of a commodity system. With what we're doing now, that in a good year, well, yes, you make money. In a bad year, you've got to batten down the hatches. And so we're trying to find that happy medium, because we've still got debt, and that's another part of the big picture.
Debt has to be serviced.
Yes.
And one of the ways of servicing it is actually making sure the money, more money, is staying in your pocket. So that's looking right. At decreased off-farm inputs. And so one of those is actually the composting, which you talk about. Can you just talk to us about how you compost and how you compost on a large scale?
So we're calving, we're milking all year round, so one of the problems here is cows get soft feet during the winter. So we put down bark chips on our laneways, truckloads of it, so that allows the cows to walk quite happily. We get
because you're high rainfall where you are, and pugging up of those laneways is a big problem. You can end up on a wet year up to your knees in mud.
We don't want our laneways pugged, no, yep. But... yeah, it is a problem, you're right. So we're trying to address that by putting down bark chips. And then that starts breaking down naturally, just with the carbon-nitrogen cycle, with the cows walking on it and urinating on it and shitting on it, and it starts breaking down. So we scrape that up and then begin our rows with that and bring in chook manure as another nitrogen source to help break that carbon down and large scale. And any waste that we've got from... the feed shed, say old hay and bits and pieces can go in there too. Old cows do find their way in there as well, so just part of that regenerative nature of it too, I think.
And that goes out in the paddock as a nitrogen fertiliser?
Oh, it's not high in nitrogen, it's probably more carbon.
Carbon?
Yeah. Okay. It has got some nitrogen in it, but it's pretty well balanced. Our last soil test, we don't need to put really anything else on now apart from lime. It's still quite a naturally acidic farm.
And so by doing that composting yourself, you're saving, having the Invitech truck coming in and backing up and dumping a whole lot of superphosphate in the
And a lot what Charles was talking about before, it was really resonating with that soil life, fungi life in your soil.
Because tell me, like, if anyone will just jump in on this one, which if we're adding artificial superphosphate or ammonia-based fertilisers, as opposed to a compost that you've made, created, what happens to the soil? What's going on underneath the soil when we add those artificial fertilisers? Anyone?
There might be a better one for Charles. Oh, we have done it and we still use a little bit of it. So we're not an organic farm per se. We still like to have the ability to use synthetic fertilisers. They have got their place, but we've got such a big buffer of carbon and other things going on in the soil now that it's not doing too much detriment. But if you're solely relying on synthetic fertilisers, yes, I think you're talking... It's a slippery slope, inevitably, I think.
We'll come... Okay, if you want to jump on it, yep.
Just quickly, one of the big differences between the ancient Australian continent and say, a younger post-glacial continent like northwestern Europe is Australian systems have had to make do with huge amounts less. So rather than what Tennyson called nature being red in tooth and claw, dog eat dog, Australian systems tend to be incredibly collaborative. There's in the soil, the microorganisms and others recycle scarce amounts of valuable things like phosphorus. They're very good at it. But if you come in then with big dollops of, say, superphosphate, it's like a huge overload of poison, and it shuts down those collaborative relationships and the microbiology and other things. So it's sort of quite complex, but we are dealing with a lot more collaboration and symbiosis, and that's really precious.
Well, another very creative thing you did on your farm was you and your wife Wendy, they decided to go out on a limb, as it were, and start inoculating gum logs with shiitake spore, yeah. Mushroom spore. Tell us about your fungus operation.
I was back in university back in New Zealand in the late 80s. Things were pretty tough. Interest rates were up to 18%+. I think they got to that here too. So it's a tough time. It's a good time to be at university to look in outside in and think, well, perhaps we need to be a little bit more creative with what we're doing here. If we're long on one income stream, milk in our case, and I touched on that before, we're very caught into a cycle there. So probably the big reason to grow shiitakes was to give us another income stream. It's given us another workload stream too, as Wendy can attest to. So, yeah, but it's been an interesting journey.
And did that income stream allow you to make those changes on farm?
It helps.
Yeah,
it does help. It's look, the farm supported the mushroom growing for a start, so now it's gone to payback time. So the shiitakes are now inputting back to the farm, so it's good. Yeah, now we're finding that we're able to ride things out a little bit better.
Your milk makes its way to Warrnambool Cheese and Butter Factory.
Yes.
And you were saying before they aren't, basically it's still hard. They're not. No one's looking after a farm at the farm gate milk price. What do you think about doing with your milk?
Wendy's a bit sceptical on stepping into another venture, but I'm hoping that the kids might be able to run with it. They're getting to that stage. We would love to do some on-farm processing. I'd always thought that the mushrooms and milk would make a good pâté, and they do, but on-farm processing brings its own set of challenges, so we're working on that now. So.
Okay, because you have Dairy Food Safety Australia on your back and council.
Set up costs, and do we go into more debt to do it, all that sort of big question stuff.
Okay.
But yes, the health and safety, all the issues that go along with another enterprise.
Oh, okay. Well, we wish you all the best with that way of thinking.
Thanks.
We can use the word cojones, but I think it's that just human strength that everyone has, like all regenerative farmers have. It's always inspiring for a person who lives in the city now. And I was inspired the other night. Who here went to the dinner at Mech Hall for the opening night? I think for those who weren't there, bad luck. Seriously, it was one of the best meals I've ever had. Mate of mine, Frank Kimura, who's a chef, came down from Melbourne. He's born in Spain. And he stood up in the room after cooking this magnificent meal with local seafood and also seafood from around the Victorian coast. And he got up, and the thing he talked about, other than the quality of the seafood in this area, he talked about the onions. The onions, he said, they were crisp, they were aromatic, and they made the most delicious start of it, all the dishes. He hadn't seen the onions like that. And the tomato salad that hit the table was one of my highlights. Anyway, yeah, you can cook it just putting tomatoes, basil on the table. And they all came from a garden from just near here. They came from a place called the Green Acre, and it just basically is the Green Acre. And the farmer from the Green Acre is sitting at the end. That's Jodie Lawson. Hello, Jodie.
Hi.
Okay, tell us about where you are and what you do.
So my little market garden's just 2 kilometres outside of town. I'm just on a 2-acre block, just at the end of a little housing development. And I have about a third of an acre in veggies. I'm growing really intensively on a small scale. So it's 75 15-metre beds. And I just use really small, scale-appropriate machinery and tools. And I'm just pumping out a lot of veggies from a small space.
OK, what sort of soil are you on there?
So it's river flat.
Okay.
So I'm on clay. Okay. Some of it's a bit heavy, actually, and hard to work, but it's reasonably nutritious,
is that dark,
I guess you could say.
Is that soil that you're on there? Is it,
no, what
is
not it, really.
To talk a bit more about that soil, because that's where
When I moved onto the block 2 years ago, it was just a compacted horse paddock. So I wasn't really starting with much.
Yeah.
And it's been a process of really kind of quite deep cultivation, using a broad fork and double digging and trying to get the depth of the soil and getting rid of some of the compaction from set stocking over 100 years. And adding lots of compost, remineralising the soil with rock dust and other rock minerals, worm castings, biological activators. I use a few biodynamic things, like 500. And the soil in 2 years looks remarkably different, actually. The colour of it's changing, the depth of it is changing, and there's good life in the soil, really noticeably.
The smell of it.
Yeah. It feels like soil, not dirt, if you know what I mean.
Paul,
yeah.
you said smell. Tell me about why you said smell.
Oh, going back to my time in Rotorua with my grandfather out making compost in his veggie garden. Well, Wendy's a pretty good veggie gardener too, so we realise the importance of just that. Anyone who farms should know what their soil smells like, richness and...
And its structure, does it sort of crumble in your hands and instead of be kind of clods of heavy clay or just sort of dust that shatters,
Jodie, why do you think your vegetables taste so good? Because they do.
Thank you. I think a really huge part of it is the freshness of them. So because I'm 100% direct marketing, so I don't wholesale to a supermarket or a grocery, I'm able to harvest everything and sell everything within 24 hours. In fact, my veggie box customers get their box of veggies the day the veggies are harvested. So they're as fresh as they get unless you're growing them yourself. And there just isn't... I mean, a broccoli... You take a broccoli in the supermarket, it was picked 2 weeks ago, it's just got nothing in it. There's no vitamin C left in it. It's limp. It's got no life. And a broccoli picked that day it's an incredibly nutritious thing if it was grown in good soil, yeah.
Tell me about the relationship between nutrition and phytonutrients and flavour.
Oh, well, it's a huge relationship. Actually, Charles wrote about this in your book. You could probably talk about it more eloquently than I could.
Can I do this for a second?
Yeah.
Charles, you wrote about this eloquently in your book. Call of the Reed Warbler, which is available for sale amongst other books over there.
Yeah.
Talk about phytonutrients.
Look, I was privileged to get to know and work with a wonderful professor who's now retired up in Utah State Uni, and he studied animals in that prairie, tougher landscape. And it's the same as Africa and Australia. We ourselves and grazing animals co-evolved, in the case of humans, in the savannas. So the women would hunt, the women would gather 400 or 500 plants they would recognise for all sorts of reasons. The men, this is a typical hunter-gatherer society, would hunt. And the animals they hunted would be grazing a variety of plants, many of them shrubs. And they knew if they were they needed some medicinal, or if they were missing a nutrient, they knew which shrubs to go to. Animals, even our domestic animals today, can detect 400 or 500 different chemicals. We're hardwired for those chemicals. And so what this professor found, he started to look at the phytochemicals, which is what comes through photosynthesis in plants on these shrubs. And there's 40 to 50,000 at least. We're talking about terpenes, tannins, phytosterols and stuff. And if you're eating healthy meat off a healthy, diverse landscape, you're accessing, particularly if you're, as the good chefs know, a lot of the nutrients are in the offal and in the fat. You're accessing nutrients you can't just get particularly out of Woolies or somewhere, just through veggies, etc. So that's the importance. We're co-evolved in our organs, gut, everywhere, to detect nutrients we need. Any pregnant mother would know what craving means. It's actually not rubbish to have a bit of oyster or something. It's your body telling you there's a certain mineral that's lacking. And And the animals are the same, and so the phytonutrients, which we've eliminated from our diet, are really crucial.
So when we've got a healthy soil and plants like Jody are growing, using these traditional techniques, the plants are going, they're searching for them. They've got desires of their own. They're going and working with the mycorrhizal fungi, are they, to get these compounds. Whereas if we're using artificial fertilizer, we're simply feeding them up on, is it nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. So we've only got a really small palette of nutrients that are going into the plants. They still look the same, but when you're growing like Jody does, they're just a lot more complex in phytonutrients and flavour.
And just one other quick example. I was involved in a research program which is now spreading, where we're planting things like Australian wattles, which have got a lot of tannin, and the animals can go along and eat that, and they're killing off intestinal worms without having to put drugs into them. So we can be a lot smarter about what we're planting, and it all comes back to that magic word in a good landscape, diversity. Diversity, really.
Diversity. Yeah. What's something that Ros was talking about before, I love the way you described that you set up the stockyard so you can handle them. Most stockyards have been set up by men. They're square, they're big, there's lots of steel and concrete. But there's something about women in the stockyards. I grew up on my dad died when I was young. Mum handled all the animals. And there is something different. When a woman's in the stockyard, there is a slightly different relationship to the animals. You were talking about Temple Grandin before. I want to talk to you about flavour and the way that an animal behaviour. Can we talk about that for a second?
Oh, I'm a believer, I suppose, that, it's sort of like Jody, what comes from a good soil and how it's raised and, how fresh it is. And with animals, like I think I mentioned before, healthy, happy animals that aren't stressed are going to actually, and their handling and their lives, what you can do with them is that is higher in, in the end run in omega-3, and that's what we're feeding ourselves, so you have to, you have to look after that.
I speak to Steve Earle from Labimba, and he's a proponent of eating older animals, older cows, but he says if they've had a really good life, they've been well handled, they've had a really good treatment throughout their life, good nutrition, but also a good animal husbandry, or I'd also like to throw in the word in whiffery as well, because so many of our really good farmers are women, that if they've been treated well, they can eat animals, even dairy animals, that are older, like 10, 11 years old, whereas we're throwing away our dairy herds into the mincers for meat that goes to the America, we're saying, at 2 to 3 years. Anyone, just pick
it up. I can't talk to that. Can you talk
Paul,
to that?
Paul, you're not.
I can. Steve has had some of our older animals. I think you're right. They're pretty well fed at our place. That's number one. And that dropping that stocking rate probably helped that a little bit more. They're getting perhaps a bit more pasture in their diet relatively. It does help. So they're in good condition right the way through their lives, really. So I don't think too much stress generally too. That helps, as you said before. So.
Yeah, I think, when you've got a close relationship with your animals, that's actually can result in a really quite beautiful product. Like we yard wean our animals and...
What's that word again, sorry?
We yard wean our animals. So most, the farmers around me, they take they're mainly veal producers. The animals are ripped off mum and put on a truck and sold into, an industrial system. We like to... set them up for life. I become their very best friend. They quieten right down, I think that has a lot to do with the response and their movements on the farm. That's one of the things that, helps set them up for, and, I hate to say it, but, more flavoursome, more high-quality meat. And, it's interesting because there's a lot of really amazing female farmers out there with cattle. And you said something about this before with, the market gardeners. We were having a chat before. What was that, Charles? I hate to deviate from you. You said something about 70% of...
Oh, yes. I mean, the stats are that if the total production of food in the world, 70% of it comes from peasant farms less than 2.5 acres. And on that, the converse of that is modern Western society wastes 30% of its food. But on those small farms, 70% of that 70% is produced by women, but in a patriarchal society, so they don't actually own the land, but it's women who are producing the majority of the world's food. On farms that use a lot of the agroecological principles of diverse food plants and all the rest of it. So, all power to the women. And I say that because I've got a wife and three daughters, of course.
We've got a small... You're working on 1 acre. You've got 250 acres, haven't you, Roz? Paul, you happy your place is?
The home farm's just over 400.
And Charles, you're on...
A couple of thousand acres now.
Yep. OK, but you're all here in the one room talking about the same thing, regenerative farming. What would you say, if we're using that word, what unites you? What is it? What would be the themes that unite you? So people, when they leave here, they know, I know what regenerative farming is. How would you describe yourself to someone else?
It took a whole 500 and something pages to work through what regenerative ag was with Charles' book. It's pretty hard to, I think, sum up in just, a few things, but...
I'm hearing Charles's brain ticking over to answer that one.
I think these guys are doing a great job.
Soil health. So it's
your creative relationship with the soil that would be the start of that conversation about regenerative farming.
We're all doing different things with the soil, though. So yeah. I'm using animals with the, solar panels on the graze, and Jodie's more, biological activants for the vegetables. Mm-hmm. And I think Charles's book also beautifully explains when we talk about regenerative ag is personal health and well-being and happiness as well. And... congratulations, Charles.
Thanks. The critical thing, I think, is, soil's fundamental, but you can't pull any of the other four functions out without everything. They're all so interconnected. If you get deeper plants growing, you've got better water absorption, then you've got better soils and biodiversity, insect, pests, parasitic wasp control, birds, all. And then this aspect as well, and which drives the whole thing. So... I think it's well summarised.
And the social functions. I think that's really key as well. I think farmers who are connected to their communities and are selling food directly into their communities and sharing how they're farming, I think that's so hugely important. And it's the opposite of the industrial farming system.
A bit more accountability.
It's broken. Yeah. That was the end of that sentence.
So I can elaborate a little bit. Yeah. It's that thing about, when you go to a supermarket, and you're looking over, the vegetables in that nice cellophane pack, how do you know where they're grown or what that beef is, what breed is that, what was it fed, how was it treated? Do you know anything about the provenance of that animal? But, when you deal directly with somebody, that farmer is directly accountable for the flavour and how, whether they're going to get business back again. But also, it's not just that about the, the flavour and having a better product. It's also, I suppose, by supporting those people, you're actually going, you're supporting their ethos and their ability to function economically in a regional landscape. So, you're supporting,
Got your little story, Roz?
Yeah, that's really important.
I buy my meat from a couple of farmers because we used to kill our own animals on the farm. I'm a meat snob. I only buy the best, but a little bit of it. And I buy mine from...
Which is?
No.
Because this. Oh, you put me on the spot there.
What is it? What's your favourite part?
I haven't tried yours yet. And I get some grass-fed belted Galloway from Orialda from Alan and Lizette Snaith. And you know what? I talked to them. I've talked to them, and I turned 50 last year, and they were some of the last days of my 50th birthday party, and I was dancing with Lizette, and that's the relationship we now have. And I speak to them on the phone, and they might have a few problems or something. They pick up the phone, and that's because of those relationships. You know, there's people in this room who are part of, are responsible for those relationships as well. And we're all part of it. We're all part of it. And that's something I get from you guys. It's just my brain, the light bulb went above my head. It's not about the soil. It's about the humanity of people. It's about the humanity of the situation. It's about you and you working with the soil. It's not the soil, it's you. Because without you, if you left the place, something else would happen. I've had a really good education today from you people. And I think there's some people like in the room would like to continue the conversation. And Hilary, you've got a microphone there. And if you've got a question or comments are lovely, but you know, keep them brief.
Does anyone have a question?
There's up the front here.
Up here. I'll come round if you like, so everyone can hear.
And if you'd just be so kind as mention your name and where you're from, that sort of adds context to the situation.
Patrick Carey from Apollo Bay. With the population of the world exploding, I mean, it's going nuts at the moment, will continue for quite some time, do we need to keep with industrial-type organisations to keep the world fed, or is it possible to use regenerative processes to feed that many people?
I think we need to multiply. I think small farmers, we just need more of them. I think that the idea of just getting bigger and bigger is just a path to destruction. And I think we need more access and opportunities for young people to get into farming.
It's a great series on Netflix called Rotten at the moment, which touches on a lot of it. Rotten, about the problems with industrialised agriculture. It's well worth a look. It covers a lot of the problems that are there in the world. The answers are a bit harder, but it's right. It's probably got to come back to us, effectively.
It's a really good question because there's a lot of good people locked into the industrial farming system and we can't turn it off overnight, et cetera, et cetera, and how we phase it through. But I think things like this glyphosate time bomb, which is the world's biggest used herbicide, pushing a million tonnes now.
Can you just feel free to riff on glyphosate, Charles, because we've got time.
Well, I've used it in my early days. To grow an industrial crop, you've got to control the weeds. And there was a shift in the 80s from ploughing soil, which did a lot of damage, and then it was exposed to the elements which kill the microbiology and it's exposed to erosion. Suddenly this magic chemical, which was developed in the 60s by Monsanto, emerged, and you could do a one-off spray, kill the weeds, and then go in with new technology which drilled the seed in rather than ploughing and destroying. So it was a revolution in, they call it soil conservation farming, which is ironic now, but at the time it was saving soil and erosion. And so that's really the basis of the entire modern cropping revolution. Then Monsanto got into putting genes into particularly soybean and corn, which are the basis of a lot of the American food and feedlot system. So they put genes in where you could spray those crops with weeds under them and the genes would protect the crops themselves from being poisoned. So all that's done is encourage more and more use of glyphosate spraying, including to dry out the crop at harvest, etc. And now we've got ourselves into this trap. We've got sterile, increasingly sterile soils and this chemical getting into the human health system. So, and now, unfortunately, despite the evidence mounting on glyphosate, there's an even older chemical that's even worse that Monsanto has now got permission registered to use again in GM use for soybean and that sort of stuff. So she's still winding up.
Which chemical, John? Put you on the spot.
I'll think about it about half an hour late.
So just pulling out the point, glyphosate, Roundup, creates sterile soil, which is an antithesis to what everyone here is on about.
It has a big impact on the microbiology because one of its roles and on the plants is to what's called chemical chelation, so it starves them, but that affects the microbiology. But the big issue is it gets into our gut now. We know that. And a lot of the emerging evidence is that a lot of the major modern diseases, from obesity, to the cancers, and particularly if you think about the rise of chemical agriculture, there's almost a 95% correlation with all the immune type diseases, the allergies, the ADDHs, that sort of stuff. So that's to do with the immune system and the gut. So that's why I say I think it's going to be bigger than tobacco.
We have a question here. We'll go here first and I'll come back to you, Kate. Excuse me, can I squeeze through? Can I just disrupt everything? There you are.
Thanks, Elise. Hi, my name's Elise and I'm from Melbourne. I'm just wondering, I'd like to hear particularly from Charles how you would coin or phrase the major failings of our supermarkets, particularly in terms of their corporate social responsibility.
Wow.
I've got dollar a litre milk in my notes here somewhere, as an example. Look,
the first point is what Jodie made, that it's destructive of human social capital. In the price-driven nature, I mean, I drive around rural Australia a lot, servicing clients, etc. And just one indicator is the abandoned community tennis courts, the boarded-up stores in country towns, the closed country towns. And that's because of the get-big approach to agriculture. That's at one end. Labour efficiency, chemicals, big machines, which are destructive of landscapes, because they have these big spray and harvesting machines, you don't want trees. But the other end is the relentless drive of these big retailers. It's all cost-driven. But the big cost they don't calculate is health. I mean, if we had a full resource accounting, you'd have environmental costs, you'd have social costs, you'd have human costs in it. But our economic rationalist view only measures one indicator, and that's profit in dollars. But the big costs are those unaccounted for. And it's exactly what Jodie said. It's destructive of a better society, and that's what I think is so exciting about this event that's been organised. It's showing that there is another possibility that connects urban, rural, and I've got a daughter working, for example, in the new Melbourne urban field, and it's really exciting stuff that's starting to rebuild that whole social capital, etc. Yeah.
Thank you, Kate.
Hi, thanks very much. My name's Kate Brooks. Picking up on the social capital element, Charles, but also Jodie, you made a really good point and said the way forward is actually to get younger people back or into the industry, and I see this, I'm talking the next session with fisheries, but it's not just, you know, it's across the board. So I'm interested to hear what you think that the current barriers and how not just you as farmers can support getting younger people in, but also perhaps how the community can support that and get involved.
Well, not that I'm claiming to be a young person. I think I'm a little bit that hill. But as a market gardener, there are lower barriers to entry to getting in. For a start, it's easier to do on rented land. You don't need a lot of land and you don't need a lot of infrastructure. You do need a little bit of capital, but not sort of vast quantities. So it's not quite the same thing as getting into grazing or broadacre agriculture. Mm. And I found as a market gardener there's a really good community in Australia of mentors and peers and a lot of women that have been really supportive in my learning. But it also rests very heavily on the shoulders of just a handful of people who are willing to take interns and do that training and do that mentoring. And there's sort of a big generation of us, and there's a couple of friends in the room who are sort of about the same point in their journey as market gardeners as well, that I'm not sure who's going to kind of step up and do that next. And I'm not sure I can really speak to how people get into working on big properties.
Is this something to do with the social capital in terms of how we build relationships and networks with media to communicate information about the fact that it's not that scary to get into this industry?
It is that scary.
It is that scary. Okay, so
there's
so
enormous, how do we, enormous how do we go risks. About, there's how enormous do we go financial about risks.
Mediating there's, or yes. Providing, making it not so scary.
creating a narrative where you're not scared and you actually want to explore more. Because how did you get into it in the first place? What compelled you to do it?
I started thinking about market gardening as When I was travelling in 2012, I was in Italy for a summer, and I worked on different organic farms, and I spent a month on a market garden in Sicily, and, you know, we ate like kings. They just grew the most beautiful produce. It was a beautiful landscape. And I was reading a lot at the time about food politics and agriculture, and just started to get that light bulb moment that maybe this was something I could actually do. Yes. And then worked on various farms around Australia and in the US as part of my training before I took the plunge of starting my own. Look, there are some good programs around Australia for market gardeners. In Maruya, there's the Sage Community Gardens has an internship program where a young, I say young, but I just mean a beginner.
Yes.
There's no age limit on this, can apply to use a small market garden for a year as part of their training. And then they're off on their own, but they get that year of someone else's land and someone else's equipment. And I'd love to see something like that multiply across small country towns around Australia, because it's an amazing opportunity. Yeah. So there's a few things happening. Yeah. Little
there
seeds.
Are. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think we're almost about ready for a coffee. All right.
Is there one more question?
We've got one more question.
Yeah.
I think we do.
Before we get to that question, Helen, you go over there.
Yes.
Sorry, Hillary, you go over there.
You call me Hill.
Okay.
That's okay. Everyone can call me Hill.
But, like, we're about to break up this session. If there's one thing that the farmers can think about if they want to start the journey towards becoming a regenerative farmer, or just some ideas, what would you recommend to the farmers in the room?
There's some good books to read, isn't there, Charles? There's some good books out there. There is,
and also what Jody said, I think.
It'll be called the Reed Warbler.
Well, that's right.
$39.95.
What Jody just did, I think, is go out and learn before you make the mistakes by working with really good people, whether you're backpacking or finding an organic community or, as Sage does, etc. I think that would be one of the first things I'd recommend. Do your apprenticeship without losing a lot of money doing it. Mm. Yeah.
Keep your ears and eyes open.
Yeah.
Shut up and learn. All right. Speaking of shut up and learning.
Yeah, the other thing that you could do, though, like, because it's not possible sometimes, it's good, you know, you can do that as a market gardener, but with livestock, that gets a little bit tricky. But I would say, you know, connect with, social capital in terms of connecting with, there's sort of, land care groups and different, like we started up Waycoast Regenerative Farmers, and that's been really good for, because, I'm at the beginning of my journey and there's certain things that, I'd like to be educated on and you get group capital to actually bring that education to a group of people. So, and farming's quite isolated when you're out there on your own. So if you can, work out, other problems and work with other people and just nurture that, personal health as well, that's actually, that's really important, I think.
Jody, as an eater's in the room, what do you recommend to the eaters in the room? How do we join in becoming regen eaters?
Shop at your local farmers market.
Yeah.
Join a CSA, a community supported agriculture program, to get either whether that's for meat or vegetables or dairy. They're around, And just get to know your local farmers and buy direct from them, so they get 100% of your spending dollar. Yeah.
Hillary, last question.
You actually stole my question. My name's Sam. I'm from Beach Forest. I was just going to ask, as a young farmer, what's the one piece of advice you would pass on, or perhaps for those who are not so young that are what would be your one sentence advice, I suppose, to summarise?
Depends on your industry.
I heard Don. No, I think they're all similar. Yeah, Don Lidgerwood spoke at a Otway Harvest Trail meeting recently, and I think he touched on resilience. But how do you teach that? I don't know.
Get your hands dirty would be my advice.
All right, we've got some. Sorry, mate, but we have to leave it now because we've got to run to a very tight schedule. We're about to break now for morning tea. I'd like you to have morning tea, then come back at 11:34 and 30 seconds. All right, but before we do that, would you please thank Jody Lawson, Paul and Wendy Trout, and Ros Denny and Dr. Charles Massey. Thank you so much.